Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled, Nirvana and Samsara Are the Same. Wait, what? By Eric Weinberg. Samsara and Nirvana are two sides of the same coin. That is wisdom. This is a talk about contemplating the view unfolding into meditation, and meditative experience unfolding into wisdom realization. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everybody. So good to see you all. Thank you for coming out. I see people I know and people I haven't met yet. Very grateful for everybody who came. The handout that you're getting is something that's part of my daily practice. I use it for an aspiration, you know, for a way to cultivate altruistic intention, because I'm not enlightened yet, so I have to work on that a bit. And I also use it sometimes as a dedication. It also happens to be the answer to the question of the title of the talk. What happened here was, I'd been reading some stuff that Garchen Rinpoche had said. Garchen Rinpoche is a great Drikung Kagyu master. And he said, samsara and nirvana are inseparable. And I said, wait, what? So I just like, you know, I thought this was more like you want to get out of samsara so you can get into nirvana, but apparently that's not the case. Which for an ordinary person like me seemed like it was worthy of investigation to see what he was talking about. And so I tried to build this talk around it. Meanwhile, as I did that, I thought back to this prayer. And what this is I took one of the oldest sutras, the Sutra on Loving Kindness, sometimes called Metta. And I kind of, Buddha forgive me, I changed some words. Of course, the words are changed anyway since they've been translated in many languages and who knows what happens in the translation. But anyway, Buddha forgive me, I took his sutra and turned it into an aspiration prayer. And that's what this is. For those of you who are online, with Lama Kathy's permission, and since I didn't get imprimatur for this before, I'll get her permission. And with her permission, we'll put it on the website so that people who are with us online can have it too, and others as well. If I don't get her imprimatur, oh, you guys have like, you know, compartmentalized, top secret, classified information. So, I mean, how you'll handle that, I don't know. But I don't think the FBI will come after you for it. So anyway, what I'd like to do is to start as we usually do with the refuge prayer. And I'd like to say it together in English two times and then chant it together in Tibetan the third time. As one of the reasons that I like doing it in English is it's our first language for everybody in this room. So, these are words that are worth contemplating and deeply considering what the meaning are. And it's hard if you're not a native Tibetan speaker to do that, since there's a lot going on in your mind when you're speaking a foreign language. The reason we'll do it the third time in Tibetan is that there is blessing attached to that, because so many great masters for thousands of years now have done this same refuge prayer in that language, and it connects us to them. So, in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Sanje Chudong Suki Chodnam La Chung Chu Pardu Dagni Kyap Suchi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Sunam Ki Rola Pinchu Sanje Rupar Sho. Thank you. So that quote from Garchen Rinpoche, here's what it says. We have said that everything has the nature of the three kayas. And when you realize it, you realize that samsara and nirvana are not actually separate. Even though they're not separate, temporary things do appear separately. So this is what the Buddha had realized, and we call the perfection of wisdom. So what is the perfection of wisdom? Is it the knowledge of the natural state of mind as it actually is? It is said that the Buddha possesses two kinds of knowledge or wisdom. That is to know things as they are, and to know all things as they exist. To know things as they are is to know that samsara and nirvana are inseparable. And in reality, myself and others do not exist separately. So ultimately, you know, we talk about this deep, fundamental teaching, one of the four seals of Buddhism, as being emptiness, which is like confusing. Because, I mean, this table seems to exist. How can it be empty of existence? I seem to exist. You can hear me. You can see me. And so forth. How can it be empty? What it means is this table doesn't exist on its own. It depended on everything that's happened, let's say, since the Big Bang in order to appear here. Same with me and same with you. Our issue is that we kind of like isolate everything as independent things and think they actually exist on their own. And that's not true. And because we do that, we also have all these habits that go with it. So there are things that we like and things that we don't like and things that we don't care about. And we start to get really, really deeply lost in labels and judgments. And every time we do that, which is what we do moment to moment all day long, even in our sleep, we deepen the habits and we deepen the judgments and we deepen, you know, our tendencies and our propensities to react to things in one way or in another. So, Alan Wallace says, that's why there's something unsatisfying about the way we live. But this need not continue. Otherwise, the Buddha would never have troubled us by pointing out the unsatisfying nature of life. Even a successful life, delightful family situation, a good job, a sunny day. Why is there an element of dissatisfaction and anxiety in all these human relations lying so often just beneath the surface, even in times of pleasure? Something is awry, but the fault is not outside of us in the environment. Samsara is not out there, but rather in the way we experience our environment. To target it precisely, samsara is in the quality of our minds. Our minds are not functioning in accord with reality, and therein lies the problem. So what does that mean? Well, it's kind of like there are these parables in Buddhist literature, you've probably seen them, like the parable of the snake and the rope, where at dusk time, a farmer goes to his barn and he sees a giant snake coiled up in the corner and of course freaks out and wants to kill it, wants to get rid of it. Adrenaline just goes through the roof, blood pressure like crazy. It's just totally instant reaction. However, if he had turned on the light and saw that it was a rope, he would see that it wasn't something he needed to kill, but he would see that it's something actually pretty useful on his farm. Meanwhile, that reaction seems real. That adrenaline, when it's high, will convince you that there's real danger. And that fear will make it seem real. Well, we react to all kinds of things that way, and it depends not on what's out here. What it depends on is what's in here. And so what the Buddha taught is for us to train our minds. And the way that we train those minds is to begin with some basic stuff, like, okay, let's set our aspirations every day. The key thing about this is every day. Let's train ourselves in being able to drop a thought, even in the midst of a mind storm of adrenaline and fear and anger and lust and all that other stuff. When that stuff starts coming up, we can either go with the story that our reactions are telling us is reality, or we can drop the thought. Dropping the thought, there's a little space, a little openness. And if there's an aspiration for goodness in your mind, goodness is so conducive to the human mind and spirit, wholesomeness is, that it actually gives us a chance for clarity. I'm not saying there aren't things in life we should be should not be angry about. Anger is not the problem. However, aggression is. So when we see an injustice or we see something that's wrong, that urge to say no or to stop, that's perfectly fine. Where we get ourselves in trouble is when we let the whole thing morph into a justification involving hate and aggression. As a child of the 60s and early 70s, and having actually been involved in Vietnam War protests and so forth, I can tell you, a lot of my friends, we're all pretty old now, but a lot of my friends still are carrying anger and hatred for something that is long gone. And it's ruined their lives in many ways. I think Ram Dass said, work for justice. Say no to things that should be said no about, but learn to drop the hate. Learn to drop the aggression, because when change happens, and it surely will, what will you be left with? You'll be left with that story that generates these like negative emotions. And those negative emotions and afflictive emotions and things like that in the Tibetan tradition are called kleshas, and we all have them. That's where we all get our, I think I've got this right, Paul Goldstein will know. I think that's where we develop our reaction formations. Is that right? Is that the right terminology? Close enough, okay. So, what we've been taught is that aggression and ignorance and passion are considered the three poisons. And they come into conflict with this need we have for spaciousness and openness, because they fill the whole scene in our mind with the stories we tell ourselves. And that's precisely what Dharma practice is all about. Almost, I can't think of one that isn't about that in some way. And there are many different practices because we need many different approaches. We're taught that the Buddha is the physician, and practicing what he taught, the Dharma, is the treatment for what is afflicting us. It must be said, however, that the treatment is not like surgery, where we cut out afflicted parts and pieces and throw them away. The treatment and the healing process is the opposite of that. Because one of the other things the Buddha taught is that everything that appears and exists arises with causes and conditions. That's like a wing of that teaching on the interdependence of everything. So the thing about practicing the Buddha Dharma is that it dissolves the causes and conditions that cause afflicted emotions to arise. It doesn't steal the energy. So if you're a mom and you're seeing something unjust happening to your kid, your instinct to say no is really correct. If you see war or other injustice, your instinct to say no is really correct. However, the story that brings about all this atmosphere in your mind of hatred and anger are not helpful to you, and will create causes and conditions. It is a condition. And so it'll take that condition and will create causes for further unhappiness. And that's what the Buddha was talking about. And that's why samsara and nirvana are right here, right now, both of them, all depending on whether we're creating the causes and conditions for happiness, or we're creating the causes and conditions for harmfulness. There's this story that I really like. I won't tell it now. Jeannie and I are going to go to Scotland this summer. A good friend of hers was invited to go on a retreat, and the friend invited Jeannie, and Jeannie said, well, I don't want to go without you. I said, okay, let's go. And it's on this island of Iona, which is considered a sacred island. It's only 3 miles long. You don't go there if you want something to do. But it's considered a sacred island, one of those energy places in the world. So a lot of people go there for retreat, or there are a lot of tourists and day trippers in the summer and stuff too. But few people stay there. We'll be staying there for 8 days, I guess, because there's this retreat for people who play harp. It's called Healing Harp. Well, I don't play harp, neither is Jamie, but we're both going. So we'll see what happens. Meanwhile, this island is famous because there was a guy, a king named Columban, in Ireland. And, you know, there used to be a lot of war and just warlords and stuff in the first millennia of Ireland. And he won big. But the whole thing of war disgusted him. You see how that ties in? It's like he did what he had to do, but it just was, he didn't want to continue with that story. He didn't like the blood and guts and the arrogance and all that kind of stuff that goes with winning. And so he actually took vows for religious orders, and he sailed out of Ireland to this little island of Iona, and he built himself a little monastery there. It became, it attracted a handful of other monks and then eventually some nuns. It's where the Book of Kells, if you know anything about the Book of Kells, that's St. Columban did that in his scriptorium. Anyway, Vikings eventually got there and martyred all the monks and nuns and burned down the monastery, which was made of wood. Consequently, because of the superstition that where holy people were martyred, it made the thing holy ground. A lot of kings from all over Northern Europe are buried there with them. They all wanted to be buried there because they thought that's where the doorway to heaven was. Okay. So that all happened. And then somewhere around, I think, 14th century, a local named Oran decided he wanted to rebuild the monastery because he had spiritual leanings, so he wanted to do something. And because there was some druidic tradition and all that kind of thing, in ground that was sanctified in that particular way, in order to build a stone structure, they felt like, I don't know why, that there had to be a human sacrifice to the local gods and stuff like that. It's crazy. So he volunteered, Oran did, figuring that he would create the conditions for this aspiration of his to come forth, even if it cost him his life. He's pretty devoted. And what they decided on was to be buried alive. So they buried him alive. They came back 3 days later and they dug him out in order to do some other, you know, funerary kind of things. He was still alive. And the first words out of his mouth were, "Well, now I've been to hell. It's not half as bad as you guys say it is." So this idea of heaven and hell, even in that tradition, any tradition has to do with the game that's being played in the 6 inches between your ears. That's what the Buddha taught. That's what Saint Oran figured out too. Of course, you know, those other people, they didn't get that. They felt that was blasphemy, by the way. So they actually did finish the job, and he's buried there. I'm going to go visit him. I'm looking forward to that. I like that. So what do we have here in Buddhism, rather than human sacrifices and so forth? There's a whole variety of meditation practices and techniques. And what they do is pretty important if you're interested in changing the conditions from which samsara and nirvana arise, the conditions where energy might arise as something powerful and useful as opposed to something that's afflictive and frightening. And mind training is all about that. So what we're told, as Marcus talked about last week, is we always want to be attentive to the three excellences. Those are excellent in the beginning, excellent in the middle, and excellent at the end. Excellent in the beginning is setting an altruistic aspiration, setting some kind of reason for doing meditation that goes beyond the selfish one of just wanting to get out of pain, just wanting to cut that part out of ourselves. You know, I mean, we all come to Buddhism in part out of the sheer ignorance that has caused our pain in pain, and we want to get rid of the pain, and we're hoping for an antidote or a surgery or make things better. And somewhere along the line, you realize that what gets better is your relationship with your own life. Life brings what it brings. It's mysterious. And it's something that some people can try to talk about, you know, as karma coming to fruition or not, or whatever that may be. That's above my pay grade. But as somebody who's been meditating daily since 1974, I can tell you what is possible is that we can work with whatever comes up in progressively better and better and more fruitful and helpful ways if we just follow these three excellences. So one of the reasons I passed this out, and we'll read it together in a minute, is that it's a good way to set that aspiration and cultivate that view that everything's connected and that it can be connected in goodness and wholesomeness. It doesn't have to be just connected by our stories and our reactivity and so forth. The second thing is to practice properly. Practicing properly is interesting. And I mean, I'm a kind of, one of my biggest faults is pride and arrogance. I think I'm better than I am. It's really true. It's a huge, huge obstacle. Why? Well, it turns out, it's taken me a long time to realize these things, but these practices that were given are designed by people who've been there and done that. They're ahead of us on the path. Some of them are fully realized, and they understand the obstacles that we encounter. And so they say, okay, if we go through this kind of evolution of practice, starting out with altruistic motivation, and then resting our minds a minute in refuge, literally recognizing that the Buddhas aren't here to judge us, they're pulling for us. That's why we take refuge in them. They're pulling for us. They want us to be enlightened even more than we want to be enlightened. They understand that for them, their own freedom ultimately is tied to everybody being liberated. They get that. We aspire to get that. So we say that stuff in prayers and stuff. So we've got allies. And if we take a moment to take refuge, what we're doing is connecting to our allies. Most of the time, we forget. And it's not visible, and it's always helpful to remember. And after that always comes bodhicitta, right in this refuge prayer that we have, is that through generosity and the other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Well, what the Buddha taught is actually that enlightenment doesn't happen except for in the condition and in the conditions that we call compassion. So here's what happens. We take refuge and we realize the Buddhas are pulling for us. And then we remember that we're taught that we have Buddha nature. Actually, we have the exact same nature, same kind of body even, as previous Buddhas, enlightened beings. And it's like, so as far as our presence in this life, we've got what we need. We already have that nature. And then this generosity and other good deeds, what that refers to is what we call the six perfections. If you know them, they're generosity, ethics, patience, joyful diligence, meditative absorption, or one-pointedness, and wisdom. And so what we're doing is just praying that the atmosphere that comes from cultivating those things fills this state of being that already has Buddha nature. So we cultivate atmosphere or conditions within ourselves for enlightenment to arise. Then there's a whole bunch of, depending on the practice you're doing, things you can do. In Tibetan or Vajrayana Buddhism, we do mantras and we do visualizations. And when you visualize yourself as Chenrezig, all of a sudden, you're kind of softening this hard image you have of yourself, and you kind of accept, at least for a moment, that your story is Chenrezig's story. And Chenrezig's story is your story. And if you do that again and again, what happens in our daily life is we start to see that actually kind of, you start to see the relationships there. In fact, relationships to similar events change. So there are things that happened to me like 20 years ago that were devastating and just tore me apart. And I related to it in the way that somebody who was devastated would relate to it. Similar things, maybe not as dramatic, have happened since, because life just, sometimes you get tomatoes and sometimes you get radishes. It's a tossed salad and you get what you get. Now, there's a little bit more spaciousness, just a little bit, just a crack. And I'm able to work with that a little better. I'm able to bring some compassion for myself to it rather than self-doubt and self-hatred for screwing up again that brought about all this crap and, you know, I should have seen that coming and blah, 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 all that story. Well, now I recognize when that story is arising and I drop it. And in that space, I remember the end of Chenrezig practice. For those of you who know it, after you do this whole practice, you're visualizing yourself as Chenrezig. You're visualizing every other being in the universe as Chenrezig, and then you dissolve it. And you rest in just bare openness, just open. With all this kind of really positive energy that you've engendered, sooner or later, your brain kicks in and there are thoughts. So the and sometimes the thoughts are your laundry list, and sometimes there's something very elevated. It doesn't matter. And the instruction is, change your first thought into the thought, I am Chenrezig. That's the end of the practice. Then you dedicate the merit. So you do that again and again and again, and sooner or later, when the chips are down and you think you're seeing a snake, even though it's really a rope, and your adrenaline's going through the roof and you're scared and all that kind of thing, you drop the story. And in that openness, because you've created this new kind of karma, this new kind of condition inside your mind, what arises is, I am Chenrezig. And you rest in that, and maybe a little wisdom comes in that spaciousness, a little freedom, a little intelligence, a new, more skillful way to respond to what life is delivering. And that's the nature of the Buddhist path. That's kind of an expanded version of how to, of how to practice properly. We have to bring our life to the Dharma, and we have to bring the Dharma to our life. That's practicing properly. It's not a separate thing to help remove suffering. It's not a separate thing like that at all. It's a thing that helps transform the way we are, our way of being in life. So then the third part is excellence at the end, where when you catch a little bit of that goodness, or even if you don't, you have to make the assumption that something good was generated by this exercise. And it's important. And then, no matter how you're feeling, whether you feel better or you feel worse, and either can happen, frankly, on any given day, doesn't matter. You take up the goodness of having practiced, and you give it away. You dedicate it to the enlightenment you wish for yourself. You dedicate it to that enlightenment. You dedicate it to that same enlightenment for all beings without exception, even the people causing you pain. And you take a deep breath and slowly get up from your cushion and move on with your day. This is the reason why it's often said that before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water, or in our case, maybe do the laundry or do the dishes. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. We're still going to have to chop the wood and carry the water. The issue is what's our relationship to life? That's the issue. As Jim Dunn, one of the senior meditation teachers here, likes to say, he likes to tell Zen stories, and there's this one story of an old Zen master who, at the end of his life, is asked by his heart student, Master, what would you say all your years of practice has brought you to? And the master thinks for a moment, and he says, an appropriate response. I love that. It can be, and it is, that simple. You know, the Karmapa, the 17th Karmapa says, in terms of the nature of mind, the true nature of mind, I don't know what I could say about that. It's just there. Usually, we think of the true nature of mind as something really high. And although I haven't done a lot of practice in relation to the true nature of mind, sidebar, yeah, right. If I speak from my own experience of this, I could say that eventually, we will return to what we were bored with in the beginning and discover that was it. So we start off by thinking that what we have right now is too simple, too ordinary. The true nature of mind must be something special, something high, something prettier than what I have now. And what we have now doesn't really satisfy our desires. It's not very attractive to us. But if you put some serious effort into your practice, then eventually I think that recognizing the true nature of mind means turning to that place where you started with, your boring, unattractive, not new, not high mental state, and actually recognize that it has been what you're looking for. Mind blown. So the whole thing about samsara and nirvana being the same really depends on our view. If we start with the view of heaven and hell, for instance, it's never going to be that unless we can drop that story. Our view we have to cultivate, we have to work on. It doesn't just come. It's like looking at the mundane stuff that we're bored with, like doing the dishes, and seeing the interdependence rather than seeing the dailiness of the chore. So the view and meditation. And our meditation is, it depends on how many tools you got in your belt. One of the tools could be I'm Chenrezig. Another one could be Tonglen, which is compassion meditation that we do. So I'm bored and I hate doing the dishes. There must be a billion souls doing the dishes right now that are bored and hating doing the dishes. May my discomfort contain all of their discomfort. May one day we all be free of it and realize the enlightened state in this very moment. Oh, that's a prayer that we can say as soon as you say it. If you can remember to say it, it changes the channel. It's really nice. I mean, if there's opera on the radio and you don't like it, you change the channel, right? Well, our minds are the same. And we use these practices for a whole bunch of different things. One of the things is that we can change the channel. And when we do it again and again and get the good of it, it becomes pretty easy because, frankly, it creates the conditions for happiness and we all want to be happy. About that, there was an article that CNBC pushed to me this week. It was about Finland. And I think it's because Jeannie, my wife, is really interested in Scandinavia. We keep looking on 23andMe and see how much DNA she's got from up there. I don't know. So it turns out, it says, for 5 years in a row, Finland was ranked number one as the happiest country in the world. How about that? So there's this thing called the World Happiness Report. You can look it up. And this guy's writing and he says, as a Finnish philosopher and psychology researcher who studies the fundamentals of happiness, I'm often asked, what exactly makes people in Finland so exceptionally satisfied with their lives? To maintain a high quality of life, here are three things we never do. So, here's some Finnish Dharma for you. We don't compare ourselves to our neighbors. That's number one. He says, there's a famous line by a Finnish poet, Kel Oni, on Se Unen Katjikun. That's Finnish. Roughly translated, it means don't compare or brag about your happiness. So you don't do it negatively, obviously, and you don't do it positively either. You remain modest, you know. Think about what this teaching on interdependence tells us. It tells us that by comparing ourselves, we're literally creating a dualistic mind state rather than a connected mind state. And a connected mind state, feeling connected, actually, you know this in your own life, brings you happiness. Feeling disconnected brings all kinds of doubt and worry and, you know, self-hatred sometimes. So he says, Finns really take this to heart. He says, I once ran into one of the wealthiest men in Finland. He was pushing his toddler in a stroller towards the tram station. He could have bought himself an expensive car or hire a driver, but he opted to take public transportation. He didn't want people to feel jealous. He also didn't want to feel separated from people himself. So the happiness tip from this guy is focus more on what makes you happy and less on looking successful. The first step to true happiness is to set your own standards instead of comparing yourself to others. Number two, we don't overlook the benefits of nature. Boy, a lot can be said about that. According to a 2021 survey, 87% of Finns feel that nature is important to them because it provides them with peace of mind, energy, and relaxation. So the happiness tip is kind of obvious. Spend time in nature. Take a walk somewhere where there's not a lot of pavement or houses or whatever. Hug a tree somewhere. Also, I would add, from Karmapa's point of view, I think he would encourage you to spend a little time and energy in working towards taking care of the earth in one way or another. Because heaven knows, just our basic lifestyle, almost no matter what we do right now, is at least part of the conditions that are harming it. So, you know, I think being mindful of nature as well as being in it is also a source of satisfaction and happiness. Number three, there are only three, so this isn't too hard. We don't break the community circle of trust. So you trust your neighbor and they can trust you. Be trustworthy. That's that second of the perfections, ethics. There's a reason why right after generosity, ethics is next in the list of perfections, even before joyful diligence and wisdom and all that jazz, even before patience, ethics. Ethics are the way that we demonstrate our trustworthiness to one another. And it's really important to let go of any selfish impulses. That's good training in order to be ethical in your behavior. In the long run, even if it costs you in the short run, in the long run, you'll gain immeasurably in happiness. There's this test they ran called the Lost Wallet Experiment. And what they did was they dropped 192 wallets in 16 cities around Helsinki. A in 16 cities around the world, excuse me. In Helsinki, 11 of 12 wallets were returned to the owner. I like that. Yeah. So, this idea that we're here and literally enlightenment, nirvana, whatever you want to call it, is in the palm of our hands, it's nowhere else, is really important. And that understanding that by practicing, we're kind of creating internal causes and conditions for seeing that and relating to life that way, as opposed to relating to it as suffering and dissatisfaction, even when we have all the happiest of circumstances around us. So if you would with me, grab the handout, and just, I'll read this. Read it along with me if you feel like it. If you don't, that's fine. Because this is essentially, as I said, my own kind of turning the Buddha's words into a prayer. In order that I may be skilled in discerning what is good, in order that I may understand the path to peace, let me be able, upright and straightforward, of good speech, gentle, confident, and courageous. Let me be contented, easily satisfied, having few duties, living simply of controlled senses, prudent, without pride and without clinging to nation, race, or other groups. Let me not do the slightest thing for which the wise might rebuke me. Instead, let me think. May all beings be well and safe. May they be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether moving or standing still, without exception, whether large, great, middling, or small, whether tiny or substantial, whether seen or unseen, whether living near or far, born or unborn, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive or despise another anywhere. Let none wish harm to another in anger or in hate. Just as a mother would guard her child, her only child, with her own life, even so, let me cultivate a boundless mind for all beings in the world, whether standing, walking, seated, or lying down. Let me cultivate a boundless love for all beings in the world, above, below, and across, unhindered, without fixed views, ill will, or enmity. May I be pure-hearted and free of agitation. May I be free of torpor and remain open, always recollecting this aspiration. This, they say, is the divine life right here. Thank you. So, there are a few minutes left for any questions, comments, observations. And the Q&A mic is right over there. Well, right over there. Paul?
See you and hear you. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
My pleasure. My question is this. Could you clarify a bit what is meant by taking refuge? Exactly. Because I understand it as sort of like, well, if I'm in trouble mentally, perhaps rather than doing what I normally would do, I think in terms of Dharma practices and so on. But I'm not sure I fully have that concept of refuge. So if you could expand on that, please.
Thank you. That's actually a great question. I think it's a multi-level answer. Basically, taking refuge is the entry point for the Buddhist path. And what's meant by that is, you know, in our ordinary view of life, we take refuge in our own observations, the stories we tell ourselves, our own identities. I'm this, I'm that, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a Jew, I'm a Catholic, I'm a Buddhist, I'm an American, I'm a Palestinian, whatever. Yeah. We take refuge in this kind of construction of labels, most of which, you know, as a baby, we don't have any of those. They're just laid on us, including our own name, right? So, when you take refuge as a Buddhist, what the basic thing that you're doing is saying, I'm going to review these things. these imputed labels, these concepts that make up me, and I want to review them in the light of what the Buddha says. And so taking refuge is, on the one hand, something you do in a moment when you want to enter the path, but it's, on the other hand, it's something that you do kind of like every moment forever once you take on the path of mindfulness. So once you become mindful of these labels and judgments and so forth coming up in your mind, one of the first skills that we learn, probably possibly one of the two most powerful skills that we learn, is that we have the power and we have the skill to drop a thought. So we take refuge by saying, I'm no longer taking refuge in that label. I'm no longer creating the shelter or the skin of my life out of that. I want to review what life actually is, how it actually hits me in the light of the teachings of the Buddha. So it's not that the Buddha's labeling us either. What he's doing is giving us the tools to do a kind of enlightened review so that our own fresh experience can be directly understood, because we have Buddha nature. We don't need somebody to tell us, we just need to find a way to grant that Buddha nature space to unfold itself in life. So we're taking refuge in, we're saying, I'm no longer taking refuge in these labels. I'm taking refuge in this process of unfolding my my spiritual truth, or my what's in the really in my heart. And I'm taking refuge in that because it's good. I think it's important to say that in most religious expressions, there's a kind of sense that you have to get something from somewhere in order to in order to achieve something sacred or holy or happy or heaven or something. You got to get a blessing or you got to get a something. You've got to have something, something enter you that isn't there. Buddhism's a little different. In Buddhism, it's saying it's already there. Our job is to uncover it and unfold it. And so we're taking refuge. The second thing is not just the labels, but we're taking refuge in this different view. It's not a view that we need to get something from somewhere else. Normally in mundane life, that's what we kind of cover ourselves with or take refuge in. When you enter the Buddhist path, you're saying, I'm leaving that shelter and I'm going to take refuge in this view that it's already there. And so the unfolding part is the Dharma. So we take refuge in the Buddha, which is already there. The Dharma, which is this process that those gone before us on this path have shared with us for our unfoldment. And then the third thing we take refuge in, because we all need connection, we all need support, we take refuge in the Sangha or the practitioners. And that includes ones like our room full of people here, and it also includes beings we don't see. Like I said, the Buddhas are filling this room right now, and they're pulling for us. They want us to be able to benefit by these things that we're sharing and talking about. They're really pulling for us. So we take refuge in those three things. Is that helpful? Okay. Well, as usual, I have too many words. There isn't time for any other questions, but I think that was a really good one. So let's do the dedication of merit prayer together in English. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thanks, everybody. It was really good to see you all.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.